Well, much has been written about the life of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, but a new book sheds light on her most enduring love affair with publishing. For two decades, she forged a successful career at the New York publishing houses of Viking and Doubleday. In fact, her years as an editor outlasted both of her famous marriages to President John F. Kennedy and the shipping tycoon Aristotle Onassis. Now one of her former authors, Greg Lawrence, illuminates her career in the publishing world with a new book. It's called Jackie as Editor, The Literary Life of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis. So here's my conversation with Greg Lawrence. Now, before we look at Jackie's life as an editor, can you tell me about your experience of being edited by her? Because the book that which she edited was Dancing on My Grave. That was a memoir of New York prima ballerina Gelsey Kirkland. It was co-written by you and Gelsey, who was with you at the time. So can you just tell us about that experience?
Well, we started in 1984 because Jackie was a huge fan of Gelsey's. And then we went on for 10 years and three books. That first book was very special. It was quite controversial. And Jackie was quite comfortable with that. And it was her first bestseller. So it changed her stature. This was, you know, at Doubleday, where she was working then. And she suddenly had much more respect, I think, from her editorial colleagues and the hierarchy at Doubleday. So it changed her standing. And I was very pleased. I didn't even know that until I interviewed a few people who talked with her at that time.
But what was she like as an editor?
She was brilliant.
Why is that?
She knew how to balance her praise, which was often quite effusive, with her criticism. And, I mean, she would write, all these notes, you know, chapter by chapter, we would turn them in, and she would write, I just want you to know the most important thing is this is going to be a great book, and the world will soon agree. Things like that, that just make you blush. And they also spur you on, because you want to please her, because she was such a, you know, an iconic figure, but also such a conscientious editor. And she would do conceptual editing. She would, you know, go through your manuscript and just question every little point. And she would do line editing. Now, she didn't do that with everyone, but she certainly did it with us.
You write that she was part of that tradition of editors who established relationships with their authors that went beyond the formalities of collaboration and commerce.
Yes, exactly. She was in that tradition of Maxwell Perkins and went way back, you know, into the early 20th century, where it was more than just commerce and the book. It was a relationship. And I knew that with us because she was very interested. And always when we would have lunch, she would say, well, what's going on? And what are we going to do next? And, you know, how is this going? But there were quite a few authors who I interviewed, and I mean, I must have interviewed 125 people, who told me she would call on the phone. You know, if somebody was going through a divorce, she would talk to them for hours and give advice. And, I just thought, this is why I started the book, because I felt like this was a part of her life that most people didn't know about. And Bill Moyers told me at one point, she was not only very private about her personal life, she was very private about her editing. She rarely allowed her name to be used. She didn't, you know, by the time she got to Doubleday, she really was just completely secret about it.
Well, let's just go back, though, because she didn't begin her career at Doubleday. She began at Viking Press. That was not long after the death of Aristotle Onassis in 1975. And this was a publishing house with a prestigious heritage and a stable of brilliant editors. Many of the authors included over the years, of course, D.H. Lawrence, Steinbeck, Dorothy Parker, Arthur Miller. Now, Viking's publisher was Thomas Ginsberg, whom she knew for at least 20 years. And I just want to read out a quote when she approached him about working at Viking, and he said to her, you're not really equipped to be an editor. It's not that you don't have the talent for it, the ability for it, but you don't have the background and the training. And you, I think, would suffer in a publishing house because that would set up some kind of competitive atmosphere with the other editors.
Yes, and she managed to work out a relationship where she was a consulting editor. And initially, she was, you know, doing acquisitions, and the two of them would plot to get somebody like Frank Sinatra to do a book, only his lawyers blocked it, things like that. But she threw herself in, you know, rolled up her sleeves, and absolutely gave herself to the process and the learning curve. And everyone was impressed by that. There were no errors. She was very humble about it. And she knew she had to learn the ropes. So by the time she left Viking, she was really quite adept at knowing what an editor was going to do. And then she moved over to Doubleday and, you know, started there, you know, with a room without a window.
But at Viking, when she began, there must have been some resentment towards her in the office because she didn't have any training, although she had had some experience editing and consulting on some biographies on Kennedy that came out not long after his death. But there must have been those in the office who thought, why can she just walk in here and be given a job? But as Gloria Steinem asked at the time, why does this woman work? Why did she work?
I believe that she realized that her, you know, her children were getting older. She had time. She was in her mid-40s, and she wanted a career. And she had, you know, once upon a time been the roving photographer for the Washington Times or something like that. And she came back to that, and then she went on for 19 years. So she was a woman who later in life realized that she needed a professional endeavor to balance her family, to balance her other interests, which were obviously considerable. And I think that's why she did it. And she loved books. There was a very close friend of hers. He was a publisher of Rolling Stone, and he visited her on her 64th birthday. She was in Martha's Vineyard. And she took him into the living room, and he said, oh, there are all these books around. And she said, yes, these are my other best friends.
But do you concede that she did get her gig at Viking because of her name and her social connections?
Well, I think it was really the friendship with Tom Ginsberg, who was a wonderful man. He's passed away, and I interviewed him many times before he died. And I think it was that connection, because they went way back. You know, he went to Yale, and he was I think one of her stepbrothers was on the same floor and things like that. And they were very close.
I just wanted to talk briefly about her interests. She loved history. She loved French, Russian, and American history. She loved the arts. And one of her big successes was a work of historical fiction about Thomas Jefferson's relationship with his slave mistress, Sally Hemings.
Yes.
This book proved to be her first big challenge at Viking. Can you tell us what happened?
Well, I think the author was a bit difficult. And, you know, that was probably one of her first books. And she was a fledgling editor. And so she had a big challenge, and her assistant told me this whole story about how, oh boy, they you know had to work their way through this in order to get the book published. She left Viking before it was actually published, and you know it was a tough time for her, but she managed to get all these things done. Then she turned it over to a different editor because it just became so difficult. But again, that's a learning experience that you go through as a very young editor, and you know that's what happened. There are these contentions between authors and editors. Gelsey and I had our contentions with her. After giving us chapter by chapter all this enthusiastic and effusive kind of encouragement, when we turned in this final manuscript at 600 pages, she cut it in half. Gelsey was quite upset, saying, oh, my God, we can't take all this out. And we knew she was going to call, and I was prepared to argue. And I heard her voice, that feathery whisper. And I said, yes, Jackie, whatever you want to do.
But do you think you would have taken that criticism and someone else cutting your book in half if it wasn't Jackie?
No. It would have been much more argumentative and all of that. But we worked through all of that. It was, and she was right. She knew how to cut all the superfluous things and cut to the chase and make sure that the drama kept going and that the reader interest would keep going. But, an author, and there is a tendency to want to just put everything in there. And she knew how to very, very carefully and judiciously cut that stuff. You know, I learned from that. I realized, oh, my God, she's right. You know, it took me a few months to realize she's right.
Now, she quit Viking two years later over what appears to be a he-said-she-said scenario in regard to this Jeffrey Archer book, which included a fictionalized account of the assassination of Ted Kennedy in 1983.
Right.
What happened?
Well, she was consulted very early by Tom Ginsberg and said, look, I have this book that I think it has potential, and you don't have to have anything to do with it. And then it went for months, and she didn't have anything to do with it. And she didn't make any protest about it. And then when it came out, it was horribly reviewed by by the New York Times, who said, anyone who has anything to do with this book, it's trash. She should feel ashamed, something like that. And the Kennedy family went crazy. And I think they put a lot of pressure on her. And within a couple of days, she resigned. And then, you know, a few months later, suddenly she was at Doubleday,
where she got a pay rise and a promotion to match, becoming a senior editor.
Oh, eventually, yeah.
And she published some exquisitely illustrated books about Versailles and stylish accounts of life in the French courts. And she did the same for the Romanovs and Stanford White's New York architecture. But you write that she lost more battles than she won running the editorial and marketing gauntlet, I guess. There were many books for which she was unable to win support.
Yeah, there was a process that you had to go through where the editors and the marketing people would come into a room and you had to make your case for the book you wanted. And as one of her fellow editors told me, I would just marvel at her, because she would propose these ideas that if we had proposed them, we would have been fired. So she lost a lot of those battles. But you mentioned the exquisite illustrated books. Those were her favorites. At a certain point, she told me, look, like a bestseller like yours or Michael Jackson's or Bill Moyer's, they allow me to do the books I really love. And those were the coffee table, but very exquisite illustrated books. And she would go all over the world to find the paper for them. And she would demand that they were produced in the most exquisite way. And that was what she loved. She wanted to inspire a kind of exchange between the best and the brightest in the world based on these books. She thought these books were magic and that she could, in a sense, carry on the tradition that she thought of as Camelot and the ideals of that era by creating these books on any number of subjects. I mean, you've mentioned a number of them. You know, when Maguib Mahfouz won the Nobel Prize, she went, you know, crazy and said, I'm going to get the Cairo trilogy. And she did, and it became a bestseller as well.
And you mentioned Michael Jackson, and she reluctantly edited it was touted as an autobiography, Moonwalk, but it was a feeble attempt. This was a book which Doubleday wanted her involved in because they knew that Jackson would respond if she was editing it. She wasn't too happy about doing it, though, was she?
Oh, she had a terrible time because, he took almost 5 years to deliver finally a manuscript, and they went through all kinds of ghostwriters, and he drove her crazy. He would call her and try to talk about, you know, what it was to be a celebrity and things like that. Oh, and she, you know, she told me, look, this was an ordeal.
But this would be a case in which Doubleday clearly saw that having her on board would get them access to people like Michael Jackson.
Yes. And he insisted that she write an introduction, and she hated it. She hated the whole idea of it. And it was like two paragraphs. And the first line was, well, what can we say about Michael Jackson?
Well, that was clearly a low light for her. But what do you think were some of the highlights of her career at Doubleday? I know that she She, as you said, she had a range taste, and she did edit Martha Graham's autobiography and six coffee table books glorifying Tiffany's, the Fifth Avenue yes. Jewelers. What are some of the highlights? Because the number of books that she edited at Doubleday are many.
Yes. I think her total number of books was over 100. She loved doing the books with Bill Moyers, the Joseph Campbell book. These were based on his television documentaries, and that kind of thing. She really just, she just got very excited. I would go into the office, and I would see her sitting on the floor, surrounded by photographs and surrounded by manuscript pages, and she would clap her hands when she knew she had it together, and she would say, "Hot spit."
That was her line, was it?
That was her line. I mean, and she would repeat that any number of times.
Then she became sick and was diagnosed with cancer. But she worked through her sickness. Not many people knew at Doubleday that she was unwell.
Yeah. And she maintained her commitment to her authors. There was a certain point at Doubleday where she really collapsed and had to go to the hospital. And there was an author she was working with, a really wonderful illustrator, Peter Cease. And she had a lunch date with him. And so she told her assistant, "Call Peter and tell him I'm not going to be able to make it." And that's just who she was. She was just so determined to get the work done and to take care of her kids.
And, of course, she died in May 1994, and I was surprised to read that some of the authors left Doubleday for other publishing houses because they said they just couldn't bear the idea of working there without her, one of them
right.
being John Loring, who had collaborated with her on all the Tiffany books. They were clearly extremely loyal to her.
I've had some really wonderful editors, but no one like her. She had a very special touch, and she took the side of her authors with such loyalty against the hierarchy of the publishing house. John Loring, he recalled on one of his first books, they had to go into a marketing meeting and the editorial board and all of that. And at a certain point, they're listening to all this flack. And she leans over to him and whispers, "Can you believe how vile they are? We couldn't even imagine this stuff. We couldn't dream it up." And that was her attitude throughout. I mean, I really think that she was kind of a maverick within the publishing industry.
Greg Lawrence speaking with me from New York last year, and the book is called Jackie as Editor, The Literary Life of Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, and it's published by St. Martin's Press.